the thing that, you know, I said to Blake, who's the game director on Jump Light Odyssey, and, you know, we've got to remind ourselves, is that it literally was just a logic puzzle. Like, we did not have enough money to take one team all the way through till, say, late 2024, which is the amount of time that Jump Light Odyssey needed to be completed. But we maybe, excuse me, could have gotten enough money to take Solium Infernum to March, like to take one team to March. So what that meant is, like, okay, well, we've got to put this one game that's already out there that has a bunch of potential and then invest it in this other game that, you know, very clearly, because we can see the wish list doesn't have as, and it's always been the case, like Solium Infernum is the weirdo strategy game, right? It was never the commercial front runner out of the two. You know, you don't get to pick and choose. It actually, the decision is made for you. And so really we were left with only two options. And one was take Solium Infernum to launch, or, you know, close the studio and let everyone go.
Sifter.com.au.
Hello, this is Lightmap from Sifter, our interview show. I'm Gianni. Today, we welcome back one of our very first guests to the show, one of the co-founders and developers of Armello and the newly released Solium Infernum and the sadly paused Jump Light Odyssey. Trent Custers from Melbourne's League of Geeks is my guest. Before we jump into that, here's what's been making the news this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's news podcast. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 28th of April.
Embracer is dead. The company will split up into three parts as CEO eats crow after the capitalist implosion reaches a conclusion.
Escape from Tarkov players are up in arms as developers introduce a $250 pay-to-win mode.
Fortnite will let you block those sweaty emotes with strangers that were just a little bit too mean if you want to.
And Fallout 76 hits a massive player milestone after the launch of the TV series.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
It's been quite the 12 months for League of Geeks, a studio that many held in high regard, myself included, and looked like a model for smaller creative, Australian-owned game development. But after investment opportunities evaporated, the team had to make a tough decision to shutter one of the two of their newest projects, the anime roguelike Jump Light Odyssey, and concentrate on the hellish strategy game Solium Infernum, and that's what we're talking about today. Trent Custers, welcome back to Lightmap.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, so let's start with Solium Infernum. I heard you talk a little bit about this back when you first announced the game, that it was something that really inspired you all to get into this sort of thing. But what was it about it that really made sense for you to make a modernization of this cult strategy game?
I think the easiest and simplest, fastest answer to that is that it really kind of just felt like a spiritual successor to Armello. You know, we borrowed heavily from Solium Infernum when we were prototyping Armello, as I've sort of said famously when explaining, you know, our relationship with Solium. We prototyped Armello on paper for 8 months, you know, and every Wednesday night we would come together because we were working out of hours then, League of Geeks, it wasn't our full-time jobs at that point. And every Wednesday, one of us would bring a new iteration of the prototype. And it was like prototype version 8 or something like that. And Ty Carey, our creative director and now the game director on Solium Infernum, he brought back a version that basically just had a bunch of hallmarks from Solium Infernum's design. So there were trickery cards and there was a prestige race and there was a palace in the middle that was surrounded by perils that you had to get into and this Fisher King. So he really just lent into that, the politics and the treachery of it, because we were looking for that in our game, you know, in Armello when we were prototyping it. We wanted it to be like Game of Thrones, essentially. Game of Thrones meets Kung Fu Panda was, you know, the tagline that we threw around for years. And so, you know, we'd all played Solium Infernum back in 2009 when it came out, or at least Ty and I had, and Ty was, you know, a sicko for it, as he still is today. And so he took his opportunity when he saw it and just pumped a bunch of it into Armello.
I'm really curious about that because, you know, why did you go for going back to something like Solium or off to something like Solium rather than piping a bit more of that into something like an Armello 2?
I mean, Armello is the most perfect iteration that we could think of a digital board game where you come together and backstab your friends as like treacherous woodland heroes. And so we love building IP at League of Geeks, as you probably see. Like if you count our sort of cancel game with Private Division, we've got 4 IP under our belt that are like almost entirely, you know, except for Solium Infernum, obviously. Vic is the ingenious archfiend behind that one, you know, that are of our own creation. So we were very keen to like just build out the studio's portfolio and IP. We knew that there was a bunch of value in that. And we just like world building, and we needed something as well for the team to get behind too. Like the team had just had a rough time spending 3 years on the project and then us having to shelve it. And so we were like, all right, well, what's going to get them excited? And it's not going to be Armello 2 because we just were on that for 10 years. So yeah, we were like, all right, well, one of them can be this thing that we had on the shelf since 2017, this concept that we'd been working on called, at the time it was called Love Boat Yamato. That was the internal title, the working title, which was extremely hard to get the team to let go of. But that obviously became Jump Light Odyssey. And then at the other end of things, Ty just pitched us on Solium Infernum. He was like, look, I didn't think Vic's doing anything with it. It's a perfect fit for us. It's, you know, we were also looking obviously at mitigating risk at that point in time with the uncertainties of the environment and the world at that point, and only having so much runway too. We needed to really like stick the landing on pitching these games. And being able to say like, hey, there's a game here that is a cult classic, like, you know, one of the 2009 games of the year, but is completely underexploited from a commercial perspective. And there's real potential here to like take this thing and dust it off and give it the League of Geeks, you know, treatment, take that triple-I quality and polish to it and, you know, release it. That was just an appealing sell, you know. And also we just, you know, the other thing too is we love video games and we love the medium, and the opportunity to take this sicko, weirdo, you know, cult classics punishing strategy game out of obscurity. And, you know, Blake, our design director and co-founder, calls it a diamond in the dark. So we've always really thought about, okay, well, you know, it's kind of a cultural responsibility too that we have here. If we're going to buy this IP off Vic, you know, of course he's cut in on the back end and invested anyway. And like, you know, but if we're going to buy it off him and take it on, like, we've got to take it out of the dark, recut it, polish it up, and just so that other people can appreciate its brilliance, you know.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about that polish, because if you look at the original Solium, it's pretty dense and at first glance not that approachable. Talk about that process of updating it for a 2024 audience.
Yeah, certainly. Like and as I just mentioned before, like, it's really at our core in regards to what League of Geeks has been trying to do for over a decade now, is take strategy games and crack them open for a far wider audience. So it was the perfect candidate for that. I mean, you know, I've got to give a shout out to Alex Smiles, our senior UI and UX designer, who was on the project from literally was working in the pitch deck when we were pitching Kowloon on the project and putting them together with Jump Light Odyssey. He's just, I joke in the studio that he deserves an Order of Australia medal. Like, it's taking this game that is, and like even Vic confesses, he's like, I'm not a UI designer, it's atrocious or whatever. Like, it's notorious for its infamously like obtuse and impenetrable UX design. And to be honest, it's actually astounding what Vic achieved, considering how complex the game is and the concepts of it and everything. But Alex honestly spent with Ty and, you know, our principal designer at the time, Jordan Fang, and then, you know, our current principal designer, Anthony Sweet, and, you know, various members of the team, because that UI and UX touches everything, right? He just basically, they went through a process of breaking the whole game into concepts, like the major concepts, the minor concepts, like all of the exceptions. And Solium Infernum is really a game of exceptions, right? So you think you have everything boxed in, and then someone like a programmer will pipe up and be like, but what if they have this artifact equipped, and then they excommunicate, and everyone's like, oh, shut up, it was perfect until you reminded us about that. So there was obviously that brute force process that Alex went through that is just, you know, a very, very talented, very committed, very driven senior UI and UX designer, like just attacking a problem and going through the design and iterative process of, you know, we set up a prototype very quickly, we got everything wireframed, all that sort of stuff, right? And we did play tests with the original Solium Infernum community and new players. We did Steam Next Fest with a demo, all that sort of stuff. So there's that process. But then there are other things that we did with the design. So, you know, one thing that I've spoken about a lot is the custom arch fiends and the ability to do that in the original Solium Infernum. Very cool mechanic if you're one of those people that like wants to get a character sheet and come up with some infernal demon and surprise your friends with what you're bringing to the match. And you love the role-playing that that brings about. But for the vast, vast majority of players, and especially as a studio, you know, we're a production house at the end of the day. We need to pay people's wages and so they can put dinner on their tables and come back to work the next day and continue making video games, right? Like, we need to make smart product decisions as well. And so we knew that one of our strengths, and this is one of the appeals of doing license as well, is that, you know, Ty said it, like, think about our strength as character designers and character creators and what we brought to Armello and the success that we brought that game, which, you know, has a lot to do with the hero design there and how they were integrated into the game. Then imagine if we brought that to Solium Infernum. And Ty by this point already had, little did we know, a full library of ideas for Archfiends and thumbnail sketches, and he'd been talking to Adam Duncan, our art director, and everything about it. So we were like ready to go. And that was a huge thing for us to, you know, if we're talking about the original and like bringing it out of the dark, but not compromising it or, you know, simplifying it to the point where the soul is ripped out of the game. Because part of Solium Infernum is that it's fucking weird and it's hard and it's awkward, right? And like, you know, it's kind of this ancient tome that if you turn the page incorrectly, it'll bite your finger off, right? And so, you know, the thing that we had to do with those characters was provide a really easy hook for people to grab onto that has appeal, that they can project themselves into and be like, oh, Ursabet, that's a really cool character. I want to be her, you know, I want to be a demon like that. And they can get straight into the game and learn whilst in the game, as opposed to meeting this 40-foot wall of friction. So there were major things that we did like that, even in the character creation, in regards to like taking concepts that you would choose in the, you know, in the original character creator and just putting them in the game, so that as you're playing the game, you're making the decisions in the context of the game, as opposed to having to do it before you even have interfaced with the gameplay at all. So, you know, we attack it from all angles. Obviously, there's a whole thing of, you know, the art direction and making a, you know, bringing into 3D, that brings a whole new raft of players that would never touch a 2D title, you know, which is a shame, but it's true, you know. And so, yeah, huge multifaceted process that honestly we had a really good grip of the big chunks and what we wanted to do, and the obviously the promise of the title and what we could do with it, and how sort of ready it was and sitting there and waiting. It wasn't going to be a hard thing to do, we felt, you know, in regards to like you look at something, you go, oh, but how would you make this for a new audience? It was like, it was quite obvious to us in a big way. And then it was just, what are we at now? Like 3 years of just like every day showing back up to work and like grinding up against those problems, you know?
I find it incredibly funny and thematic that there was a secret plan for how this all happened. And then you just kind of, it was dropped on you with all this stuff in the background. That's kind of quite poignant in the way that's kind of worked. You had to make that hard choice between those two projects, and you've talked a little bit about this already with the ABC and a number of outlets as well. But as someone who's looking outside, looking in, I have to admit I was pretty surprised by the choice between Jumplight Odyssey and Solium Infernum, because as you said, the characterization in both of those are incredible, but anime's having a moment right now. So I was really curious, could you talk us through that decision? What was the, you know, how did you get to that?
Yeah, certainly. And so I guess for context for, you know, listeners that aren't really aware, you know, we reached a point last year where we had investment fall through, and the easiest way to explain it is that we found ourselves with, you know, a funding gap, which often happens in creative projects. You know, I mean, the film industry has funding models and investors set up entirely to, you know, solve this problem. Is you're halfway through a film and you're like, oh shit, it's actually going to cost us more because the dollar shifted, or we didn't account for this, or whatever it may be. And then people actually step in and, you know, give you some funding to finish the project, which funnily enough, it was film financing who saved us in the end, right? And enabled us to get Solium Infernum out the door. But to go back to it, that's what happened to us. We had two projects, 70 folks, and with the big investment contraction that was going on, about a year plus all of the relationship building in the years before that, a year of talks about investments, like a serious investment into League of Geeks that would have secured the studio's future through 2028, just fell apart. Just for us and, you know, hundreds of other people around the industry. It's unfortunate, you know, to say for the least. But in regards to how did we then make a decision between which game to, you know, we had one out in the open, one wasn't even released yet, one was in early access. And, you know, just the reviews were just getting better and better. I think in the last month for Jumplight Odyssey, the sales increased five times, you know, fivefold. You know, it was on a real tremendous arc. And the tragic thing is, it's funny because I just actually stepped out of a founders meeting. We have one every Wednesday to have this call with you. I said, I'll be back. I got an interview. And we were, you know, running it through our heads again, this exact thing. And the thing that, you know, I said to Blake, who's the game director on Jump Light Odyssey, and, you know, we've got to remind ourselves, is that it literally was just a logic puzzle. Like, we did not have enough money to take one team all the way through till, say, late 2024, which is the amount of time that Jump Light Odyssey needed to be completed. But we maybe, excuse me, could have gotten enough money to take Solium Infernum to March, like to take one team to March. So what that meant is, like, okay, well, we've got to put this one game that's already out there that has a bunch of potential and then invest it in this other game that, you know, very clearly, because we can see the wish list doesn't have as, and it's always been the case, like Solium Infernum is the weirdo strategy game, right? It was never the commercial front runner out of the two, but it was, we had to give it a shot. We had to give, that was the only amount of money that we had was going to get one team to like May or June or something like that. And even that was a long shot, you know, when unfortunately we had to hand out the first round of redundancies. We didn't even know if that money was going to come through. Like, we're like, hey, everyone, here's the first round of redundancies, but there may be a second round if in 2 weeks we can't secure this extra funding. But Blake thankfully managed to make that that film financing funding come through, the cash flow gap funding there. So that's really, at the end of the day, it's a bit of a brutal reality of business. But it actually, there was no kind of Sophie's choice in regards to like what project do we like more, or what one do we think is going to succeed more or be more financially viable, because the answer is clear probably for anyone who looks at either projects, just like looks at a thumbnail of either project or is looking at the wishlist data or all the trajectory, you know, data, like the forecast data that we had. Jump Light Odyssey was clearly the financial front runner. Was, you know, I think we still got like 200,000 wish lists like sitting there, right? But in business, sometimes it's just like, hey, you've only got this much money. And that's, you know, you don't get to pick and choose. It actually, the decision is made for you. And so really we were left with only two options. And one was take Solium Infernum to launch, or, you know, close the studio and let everyone go.
I mean, there were rumblings all through last year that financing in studios, I mean, every week you hear about a new studio that's had to sack a number of people. But I'm curious for you, what was the sort of feeling or the pattern you started to notice when things were starting to look dire for League of Geeks? Talk us through that moment.
Yeah, we're pretty connected in the industry. So, you know, you get tremors, right? Like that you can feel, like they reverberate through your network. Someone says something, or you hear a story about something, or, you know, a comment about something, and you're like, oh, interesting. And I said this to Marie over at Games Industry Biz when it all happened, is the first time that we knew that we were at risk, really, of like really bad shit happening to our studio was in February. So about a year ago, we went to, you know, sort of conference, well, actually not a big, small conference for executives in video games. And it's one of the first, if not the first conference of the year, every year. And it really, you know, you have decision makers in the room from all the major publishers and VC funds and, in, you know, investors, like even people who work in the public market, you know, for video games. And you get a really good idea of where things are going to go for the rest of the year. And so we had dinners with and breakfast with all of our, you know, friends from various investment funds or, you know, like publishers and all this sort of stuff. And there was just a few conversations where people were like, just, you know, I remember one, like, wasn't able to like articulate their corporate strategy, like for the year or their funding. And I mean, to the people at the table, and it's not because they couldn't, but it's because they're not saying it. And that was the first time in our 15-year relationship or 10-year relationship with them that they had never done that. And so you walk away from that dinner and you're like, okay, what the fuck was that? What is going on, right? And it just makes you think like, okay, something's happening. You know, for a developer who's paying attention, what that tells you is that there's a big strategic shift happening somewhere. Because when people clam up, whether it be at a publisher, at an investor, at a platform, it's because big changes are happening and they're in flux. And so they actually can't really say anything, or they've been told not to say something. And so that was the first sign that things were sort of going wrong. And then, so we got back from that, and sort of Blake and myself, because we both went over with, you know, Ellie McLean, our production director at the time. And we're all just like, okay, shit, we got to talk to Kowloon about the situation and give them a heads up sooner rather than later. And they were great. They were really receptive. You know, they're our financing partner, co-financing partner on the games. And we just told them, like, hey, we've got this cash gap. It's coming up. We're not confident that it's going to get filled by platform deals and stuff. And so then we spent the rest of the year working platform deals and everything. And they all started coming off the table too. And it kind of happened slowly, you know, and because the scary thing about last year was that you're talking to people who, a lot of them, they didn't even know that it was coming either. It's not like they're not giving you answers because they're like, oh, we're going to cut all the funding and we just can't tell this guy. It's like they're actually in the dark themselves a lot of the time because they're not the ones, the decisions actually last year, so many of them came from folks that were like above the executive level, like major decision makers, like CFOs of some of the biggest companies in the world just made a decision to like cut funding, or at the board level above the CFOs for some of them, that we had investment teams on the phone that we were talking to that were just like in tears because all of a sudden every single deal they had on the table for the last 6 months had been shut down. So it was just when that is sort of happening at an increased pace over the year, you know, like weird things are happening and then this person's taking a bit longer to get back to you in the middle of the year. And then by October, like everything is just getting rapidly pulled off the table and all investment is kind of just shutting down around you. You know, you're walking around the town square and people are closing the shutters in front of you. It becomes pretty clear what the financial outlook is for everyone. And this is why, you know, it's really tragic what's happened to League of Geeks. Like we had 70 folks, you know, fantastic friends and talented people that, you know, there's not a single ounce of like fat, quote unquote, at our studio, you know, like everyone was one of the most talented developers I've ever met and were hired purposefully, you know, at the studio. We didn't want to lose a single one. It was the worst day of my life having to let go of, you know, 30 or so people in one hit. But the scary thing is that it's, and I don't want to be like a doomsayer, I don't want to be prophesying doom or anything, but just got to be realistic that like when every sort of major investor just takes money off the table for a year straight, like what it means is that hundreds and hundreds of development studios all around the world are just watching their bank balance decline day after day. And I mean, if you've got 70 people on your books, you're paying out over $1 million a month in wages, you know? So most folks, we're already seeing it every few days. You know, we're seeing what, you know, twice a day sometimes. Highly regarded independent studios of various scales just shuttering all around the world, you know? And unfortunately, again, I don't want to be a doomsayer, but it's not going to stop anytime soon because the effects of decisions that people made not signing projects or cutting off investment mid last year, you know, are only going to start to take effect, you know, in these first two quarters this year, you know, really.
I'm interested because League of Geeks kind of came up in about the time when we had another sort of era of shutdowns, of studios getting shut down and all that sort of stuff. And there was that movement that you were a big part of at the early start, and along with a lot of your colleagues, of course, as well, plenty of people you've talked to that built this sort of independent triple I culture, like you describe it, for making games. What do you think the impact of this is going to be? Because these are the people who are now being hit by this.
Yeah, all the questions you're asking me, they're going to make me sound like I'm some some doomsayer. But like, it's, you know, this is how I feel genuinely. It's really tragic and it's unfortunate that, like, you know, people in high places have made really foolish decisions like over the last, you know, 3 years that have put us into this position. But the difference that I see now between the GFC and the, like, just the culling of studios that happened then and what's happening now is very explicit. And during the GFC, the industry was different in the sense that self-publishing was not an option, viable option, really, in 2008, 2009. Like, it was only just happening, you know, like, I think Braid had come out on XBLA in 2007, right? And so the indie renaissance was just getting started and people were starting to put games on mobile and having some breakaway hits, but it hadn't really happened in a big way. Obviously the GFC, when that happened, a bunch of people moved into indie, you know, and then a bunch of other things happened that greased the tracks for people to actually, you know, develop their own IP, to set up their own studios for that indie renaissance, as we call it now, to take place. The difference that we're seeing now is that during the GFC, the studios that shuttered were largely work-for-hire studios who were working on third-party contracts for publishers and platforms on second-generation machines or past-generation machines like your, you know, PS2 when the PS3 was out or whatever, for bargain bin family titles, or, you know, hey, make me a, make me a Scooby-Doo racing game, or, you know, make me a Nicktoons fighter or something, right? And it's like, okay, all those games move to mobile, et cetera, et cetera. We all know the story, but it was those studios, the FIFA service, the work for, you know, well, sorry, work for hire studios, FIFA service studios, the third party studio shut it. And so they went and made great independent games. Now what we're seeing is those studios that set up around that time or that happened to survive that, that were independent, that were making great games, that have invested the last decade into making their own independent IP, some of the greatest, you know, I guess, well, independent artists and studios of our time currently, they're the ones at risk now. Because the type of investment that's getting pulled off the table isn't work for hire or service money. Like these AAA games, they still need people to, you know, pump a bunch of assets into it, you know, like from various service providers and stuff around the world. It's indies not getting their projects signed or not having their studio backed because they're a huge backers. A lot of people don't know this, but so much of the indie quote unquote industry, and this is a great thing, I don't think this is bad at all, but is also propped up and secured by silent partners a lot of the time, like NetEase, Tencent, huge Chinese gaming companies that have, you know, they'll come along and they'll buy 10% of your company for $5 million or something like that as an indie. And they don't bother you at all for, you know, however many years. And what it does is it creates a bunch of security for you to then go, okay, I'm going to go and continue getting my title signed and published by these other people, but I've got a $5 million war chest that helps me, you know, take some bigger risks or, you know, survive economic depressions or times like this. And so when all of those sort of opportunities come off the table too, and folks like Tencent and NetEase start to become more selective about who they invest in and platforms, indie funds, you know, there's no new console that they want to stock with indie titles to get the catalog up, you know, so platforms start pulling their funding and publishers are scared because they've just overspent during the, you know, the COVID boom and now their parent company is maybe going to shut them down. Like all of that stuff, what it results in is independent developers who are pitching original IP of great quality, just not getting signed. And so that's what we're going to see. And I think that's the big difference and the real tragedy right now. And the other thing that a lot of people don't talk about too is that the first thing that takes a hit with a lot of this is all of the great work that folks have done across DEI, you know, throughout the industry for the last decade or whatever. People, underrepresented developers who've worked their way into senior positions or in many cases built their own studios. You know, we take so many steps backwards with this stuff when it happens. It's just it's really tragic. It's really scary. And look, people will start signing again. It's already happening in a really selective way. I'm really confident that at the end of this year, early next year, because people don't have titles in their slate, right? If you don't sign games for a year, you're going to have a year or 2 years down the track where you're not releasing games as well. So people are scrambling for games in their slate. They just got to reconcile that with the fact that they don't want to pay the price that they have to pay for those games to fill their slate. But we'll see people sign again. It'll happen. As I'm sure a bunch of folks, a bunch of listeners maybe have heard or read, like the phrase really is kind of right now, survive till 25. And I think if you're an independent developer who either is lucky enough to just have enough cash in your bank to be able to do that, you know, you may not even notice that the storm is going on outside. Or, you know, if there are a bunch of people, like when I was at DICE this year, there were so many talented indie developers that have only worked on original IP for over a decade or whatever, who are now doing work for service stuff just for a couple of years, you know, take a project, help another studio out, do some co-dev to survive this winter because, you know, the content boom is going to come back on the other side of this, no doubt, and people will be looking to sign things again.
Are we sheltered from any of this in Australia? We've got significant support in Victoria. Other states are now putting stuff in there. What role does that sort of funding have to keep us through this storm?
Yeah, look, I think we are to some degree. Unfortunately, and again, this is no shade on the Australian funding setup because I don't actually think it's their responsibility to protect large-scale studios like us, large, you know, being on the indie sense. But most of the funding and everything is only going to really support your smaller scale devs, you know, like it's just because, you know, if you imagine the Vic screen cap for, it's like 300K or something like that. I can't remember off the top of my head for a VPF, right? It's when you got 70 people, as I said, it's $1 million a month to run the studio. So it's not even a fortnight of your payroll or something sometimes. So that's kind of where it it's going to focus its efforts is on some of the smaller studios. I would definitely say that, ironically, now is a fantastic time to start a little indie studio in Victoria or in Australia, because there is fantastic incentives for smaller studios who don't, it doesn't cost them, you know, $1 million a month or two to run their studio. You know, if there's only three or four or five of you, like that money that you get from Screen Australia or Vic Screen or whatever, whether it be through the Originate Fund or VPF or Screen Australia's initiatives, that can go a very long way. And that can get you to the end of 2025 and have a prototype under your arm. And maybe you're going to GDC and pitching that in 2025 when the markets have opened back up again and signing titles. And I've also got to say and acknowledge too that League of Geeks, like Gianni, we would not have a studio today if the DGTO did not exist, because as I sort of mentioned before, the only reason why we survived is after we made that first wave of redundancies, the only hope that we had was in 2 weeks to be able to secure an investor that could loan us money against the DGTO that we were going to get back from releasing Solium Infernum, which is also another, it's a more complicated explanation, but it's another reason why we chose to release Solium Infernum too, you know. But that DGTO, that being there, that enabled us to draw down on the DGTO and be able to save 35 jobs or something like that, you know? And that's access to funding opportunities that the film industry has had, the screen industry has had for decades before us and more. You know, they got 40% on the dollar, right? So that, and they're very matured over there and they're just starting to move across to games. Like, we're one of the first people to, you know, action this in games here in Australia. But that's one great example of how in Australia we are more resilient to these things than overseas because of just some of the funding structures we have set up. There's other things too, is like we're less dependent on, you know, big like publishing contracts and stuff like some of the larger studios overseas. But, you know, we're not impenetrable. We're not impervious, you know, like we, if you remove a bunch of capital off the table and a bunch of investment, it's just going to have an impact down the line. It doesn't matter where you are.
I'm glad you brought up the film industry, because I saw that the composer of Oppenheimer mentioned something that you took issue with on Twitter, Ludwig Göransson, who kind of put, you know, he credited his success for the fact that he didn't play video games. And I'm sure you disagree that's with that. But tell me how that make you feel to see something like that still come up in 2024 when we're talking about an industry that is massive.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess like it just doesn't, I just think good on him. I just think like Ludwig Göransson is a bona fide genius. He is a towering talent that is going to go, he's on track to become one of the greatest contemporary composers who's ever lived. The man has 2 Oscars and 3 Grammys at 39. He's also like, you know, Ryan Coogler chose him, a white Swede, to do the Black Panther soundtrack. Like, if that doesn't tell you how talented this guy is, like, it's pretty, you know, I don't know what else is. And he just got up there and said, hey, I'm really glad, this is how I see it, I'm really glad that my parents, you know, invested my time in this thing and not this other thing. And he could have said anything else. And of course, there's no doubt some loaded cultural connotations there that video games are a waste of time. But I don't know, being a game developer for 17 years and having my own studio and being on the various boards of whether it be Free Play or GDC or whatever, I think I have the perspective to also say that video games are a fucking waste of time. A bunch, you know, like, and that's okay. Like, they can be a waste of time and they can also be like the medium with perhaps the greatest potential out of all of them. And I get up every morning and, to be completely honest, the reason why I go to work is because of that potential. Like, I wanted to be in film. I wanted to be a writer and director, and I chose not to do it because, honestly, it feels like film has kind of done all the things, you know, like, where are the big innovations coming in film? And it doesn't mean that they aren't coming, but like, that's a kind of an almost complete medium. It's a matured medium. And I get to get up every morning and like boot up the computer and not know what the fuck is going to come at me in regards to game news or advancements or anything. I remember seeing that, and this is a pretty obvious one that it was going to do it, but even just seeing the GTA 6 trailer was like a moment for me after 17 years in games to just be like, wow, holy shit, these crazy bastards did it, you know? And so, I don't know. It's also, I think, when I was a young whippersnapper in games and very prideful and very desperate to like sort of prove myself and feel like I was doing something purposeful, it really ground my gears when people got even close to implying that video games weren't art or were like a waste of time or not a real job. And after a while, you're just like, They are, and they have been for decades. And the authorities who care, like, I mean, the Smithsonian had their first video games exhibition in 2011 or something, you know. So it's just like, just get up, do the work. I think artists focus not on what other people are saying, but on elevating and, you know, elevating the art form. It's all about showing, not telling. So
would you have liked him to say, oh, it's great that I get to do this and other people get to do cool things in video games as well? Does that feel like it was sort of punching down a bit? Or
You know, it's funny because I'm kind of on both camps. I'm like, I actually don't care if he's saying that video games suck. Like, it would be very funny to me if this very talented person was like, hey, everyone, thank you for my Oscar. Also, video games suck. Like, that's the funniest Academy Awards speech I've heard, honestly. And I'm here for it. Like, seriously, I give a talk every year to the first years at Swinburne. Stephen Conway, the head of games over there. I think he's still the head of games, maybe. But he gets me in to do a barnstormer of a talk, as he puts it, to the first years. And it's kind of like the 15 things that I've learned being a creative lead, or 30 things I've learned being a creative lead for over 15 years. And one of them is, like, I have a slide that just says, like, fuck video games. And I just talk about how ridiculous they are and how stupid they are and how dumb we must look to the rest of the world. And, like, it's very easy to show how ludicrous and laughable it is as a medium. And then the next slide, of course, is it talks about the breathtaking power of the medium. And, like, I've had people personally tell me that Armello saved their life. Like, they were dying of cancer and it was the only thing that they had, you know, going for them at that point in time, and gave them a place to escape to and to connect with their partner and to go on and move forward. And it's like, yeah, man, that's like what we make is magic. And it's so important. And, like, it has such great potential, like vastly more potential than any other medium. But that contradiction is the beauty and the hypocrisy of both things standing alongside each other. I just love it. I think it's there to be embraced. And every time we wheel out a new celebrity and, like, hold a gun to their back and get them to talk about video games at the Jeff Keighley show, I'm like, God, what are we doing here? You know, let the adults talk, please.
All right, pull quote, Trent Custard's video game sucks. Thanks. We'll put that on the box. That
one there. Love it.
Look, we talked on the 11th episode of this show. This is episode 229. That was way back in 2015 we were first talking. But I'm curious, because while we're keeping hopeful and thinking about the future, you've just launched a pretty exciting new project. But I first want you to have a listen to this from this episode.
So what can you do with a digital board game that you can't do with a physical board game and have it released?
The main one is obfuscation of mechanics and systems and game state, really, which is funny because that's, you know, where some of the criticism has come in about the game, but that's where we explore a lot of it. So the perfect example is stealth. In a tabletop game, you have a character on the board and there's stealth, but for me to actually see them, I need to roll my dice and blah, blah, blah. But they're there. I know where they are on the board. And obviously, even on some subconscious level, that creates a bias and that factors into my decisions within the game. But with Armello, you just can't see the character. In fact, we made more changes to the game today to obfuscate more things when a character is in stealth. So there's a bunch of that stuff. And then just the basic presentation things, you know, this is what video games do. Board games work largely on abstraction. You know, from the knights, these beautiful regal horses busts in chess, you know, that's meant to be a knight on horseback, basically. That's what it's, but we deal in abstraction a lot in tabletop games. And what video games does, or what it provides you, is we can actually bridge that gap further. We can make things more literal. We can remove or reduce the amount of abstraction needed. So instead of having these little colored pips that you're moving around the board, we have fully animated characters that move around the board and, you know, attack and growl and you know, do their boast animation and are living, breathing entities for all intents and purposes. And so that presentation level is huge.
So you've just launched a board game version of your digital board game.
We have.
Armello. Talk about undoing all that stuff you just talked about.
Well, the beautiful thing is that I actually didn't have to undo any of it because we partnered with our good friends at King of the Castle Games, you know, based in Perth and Melbourne, who've been longtime friends of the studio. You know, they helped us with a bunch of Kickstarter stuff, like with their company campaign coins as well. And they just came to us a while ago and they were like, well, a while ago, like 7 years ago. And we're like, hey, we want to make the Armello board game. And we were like, have at it, you know? But I think, Gianni, the fact that it's been 7 years since they originally asked and now it's here shows you how involved the process it was. we went through a large process with them at the start, you know, really intimately. And then also once I got their designer on board, then too. But at the start, it was all about what we want and what we expect from an official board game adaptation. And the first thing that we spoke about is the board game adaptation has to feel like Armello. That's all. Because, and it can't be like a different story or a different premise or anything. It's got to be the same premise. It's got to be what people expect. But we knew from the start, just like Baby Trent said to you, what, like 10 years ago or something, right? That we knew from the start that Armello actually wouldn't translate directly to a board game. So Rob Heinz, who, the lead designer of the board game, who's also was the lead designer of D&D 4th edition, Three Dragon Ante, the story lead on Legend of the Five Rings, very, very talented gentleman based out in Seattle, I think, or in Washington. He really took that and ran with it. And, you know, to his credit as well, every time that we were like, no, you can't change that. Like, for example, the Armello dice, they changed the dice a bunch of times and we were like, absolutely not. They have to be Armello dice. We don't want any D6, no dice except the Armello dice. And I think we ended up, there's one that just rolls the navigation, the southeast, blah, 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 around the map to resolve some things, but everything else is the Armello dice. But they worked through all of these things. I actually don't know the answer, to be completely honest. It's been a while since I've played the board game, but I don't know how stealth is resolved in the board game. I don't even know if it's in there, to be honest, but like that was Rob's. They were Rob's problems. We were like, hey, this is the sort of paddock that you have to move in. These are our expectations. Like, there has to be like the themes of contrast, night and day, the rot in the wild, you know, all that sort of stuff. There has to be the political treachery. We want to see elements like perils, exploring dungeons, like all that. Like, it's got to feel like Armello. So you can change the rules as much as you want. But if when we rock up to play that game, it's got to feel like we're playing the video game, even if the rules are different. And that's like, it's an impossible brief. And they just nailed it. We're so proud of how the games come together. And to be honest, like, we have a very, as you can probably tell from our video games, we have a very high quality bar at League of Geeks and expectation, especially of those we collaborate with. And to say that we were like blown away when we saw the actual physical products at PAX Australia this year, when Andre from King of the Castle Games brought them to show and was showing them off there at the Campaign Coins booth, is an understatement. Like, we were like, the company was talking to each other in the chat, especially Blake Ty and myself, who've been invested in this for the co-founders, you know, and been working with them on the, you know, feedback rounds and approvals and everything for the last 7 years. To see them go through, because, you know, the tabletop industry got fucking gutted during like COVID as well. So to see them go through all of that and come out the other end and just have a game, because one of the things we did say to them, we said, this has to be like a premium grand board game. Like, we want hundreds of bits, you know, like we want it. And you were going to create a mage knight, essentially. It should be ridiculous how big this thing is, and it should feel that way. And they felt the same way as well about the build quality, the component quality, the type of board game that it was going to be, like that epic board game night thing that you all gather around, and it needing to be the same, feel the same as the board game. And they just nailed it. It's amazing.
I'm curious how close it ended up landing to that paper prototype you were talking about, you know, that you spent about 8 months or so working on. Does it feel similar? Does it feel smarter? Does it feel different?
Yeah, like, it does feel smarter. Like, it's very, very, very similar. So like, moving around the board is the same, you know, like, but they've made interesting calls in regards to like breaking it up, instead of it being a quadrant, into six sectors, that makes quest distribution easier. Because, you know, when we were doing the prototype, it actually reached a point. The only reason why we prototyped it for 8 months is it got to a point where we needed two GMs to run it. And the rules were becoming so refined. We're on version like 10.6. And so the rules, every iteration, were becoming so refined that we didn't want to have to print off another 300 cards and cut them out every time we did it, you know, and have two GMs run the game and, you know, to manage the King's Guards and the Banes and the flipping of the day and the night. So all of the ways in which they've streamlined that, like, finicky and fiddly management of it, is obviously, it's a board game. So like, that's part of the enjoyment for a lot of people, is setting it up, managing the bits and all that sort of stuff. But that's where the smart sort of elements of this have been, really. It's been super impressive how Rob and his team over at Black Opal have just like taken these incredibly complex problems, design problems, that, you know, I can honestly say, as clever as we are, and especially being some board game fanatics ourselves, like Blake, our design director, makes his own war games in his spare time, right? Like, I don't even know if we would have come up with anywhere close to like some of the genius solutions that Rob and his team did. And so, you know, we we really, really backed the right horse with this one, and we're so proud of them. It's a great, great partnership.
It stopped me in my tracks when I saw it at PAX Australia last year. I was walking past the booth and I went, whoa, hang on a second. I thought this was never, ever going to happen. So I'm thrilled that it's out there in the world and people get to play it. Look, Trent, it's been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's not do an 8-year gap between now and the next one.
Sounds good.
If you're still around, then I will definitely talk to you in that time. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Gianni. It's been a pleasure.
Solium Infernum is available now on Steam. You can find out more information by heading to leagueofgeeks.com. Of course, check out the Armello adaptation as well, which is up on Kickstarter now as well. Sifter is produced by Fiona Bartholomaeus, Daniel Ang, Adam Christou, Kyle Paletto, and Chris Button, Courtney Borrett, and is edited by Mitchell Lowe. And my name is Gianni Giovanni. I'm the executive producer of Sifter. If you liked this, number one thing you can do is share it. Share it with your friends. Tell them that they'd like it. Get it on their podcast player. Hit subscribe. Say this is an episode for you. I think you'll get a kick out of it. That's a really cool thing you can do. It's free and it makes a big difference to indie teams, indie podcasters, indie developers. Sharing things is the best free thing you can do. And that personal recommendation means a lot. That's all the time we have for now. Until next time, have fun.
Hi, Chris Button here from Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Unicorn Overlord might have a strange name, but don't dismiss its tactical prowess.
It uses a tactics mode, which is similar to the Gambit system that was in Final Fantasy XII for your squad mates. And you can say, okay, well, you know, Hodrick, who's my legionnaire with the big shield, I want him to prioritize protecting the back row. They're going to take the most damage. If they take a physical hit, they're going to go down, but I need them to be protected. So you can get quite granular with this, and I reckon you could build some pretty wild builds that are totally game-breaking, but it's kind of the fun of the tactical squad-based gameplay in Unicorn Overlord.
Tune in to Drop Rate to find out why Unicorn Overlord might just be one of 2024's sleeper hits. Available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.